Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is me, Jonathan Alexander, and I'm here to host our show, Life, Laughter, Happiness. My co-host, Barbara, is coming back from a trip, so she's not here, but I'm with her, we're with each other in spirit. My guest today is Tara Thomas. Now, Tara, one of the things I found that's kind of interesting is whenever I see these people who are like motivating to others, you know, health-wise, it's usually they're in a position where I think what the word is that you have more health problems than most people do. So, I mean, it's kind of like, it seems that it's sort of like you said that you lived with diabetes, that you have diabetes. And there's a lot of people who don't have anything, who don't have diabetes, you know, and they look like they look like Olympic athletes, you know. But then you do have it, and you look like an athlete yourself. I mean, do you feel that? I mean, because it says here, I mean, like, you know, 31 years with type 1 diabetes, and you know, that's so long. I mean, have they been able to, how has your diabetes affected you? I mean, is there anything they've given you to treat it, or do they know more than they did, say, 30 years ago when you had it?
Well, first of all, I'm excited to be here, so thank you for having me on the podcast today, Donathan, so thank you. But, yeah, that is accurate. I've had type 1 diabetes for 31 years. I'm currently 48 and was diagnosed when I was 17 years old. Quite fortunate in the kind of the foundation of my health journey. My parents really developed this sense of looking at what's possible versus the problem. And, you know, I started off from age 1 until 6 with a hip disease that I was physically disabled and in leg braces for that period of time in my life. And at that point in time, and then it just translated to when I got diabetes when I was 17, it was just about you go on with life, you do what you want to do. The healthcare condition or circumstance, whatever it was I was dealing with, is just navigated around. So I was really fortunate when diagnosed at age 17. I just have not held this attitude of it limiting me. And I honestly feel today in my life, 31 years later, that diabetes does not limit me in what I want to do. I can still limit myself, but it's not because of my diabetes.
I'm curious. Yes, I mean, go on.
Well, I was going to, you would ask the question and I can answer it later, but how, what treatment modalities have changed? And I can talk about that for as long as you want, but
Good.
Do you have another question?
Do that, because that was the question. I was sort of thinking, because when you don't have it, you're not really thinking about it, but you have it, means that you must have some, you know, what of an idea. I mean, I do know that, isn't diabetes usually associated with weight gain or weight loss or something?
That is a great question. So there's a few different types of diabetes out there. Categorically, there's two that most often people hear, which is type 2 diabetes, which is about 90% of the population who has diabetes, which is where their body continues to typically make insulin, but the way that the body receives the insulin, I kind of describe it as a higher quantity of insulin is usually produced, but that quality of insulin isn't always metabolized or used by the body. So sometimes they can take some oral medications or use lifestyle intervention to sensitize the insulin they are producing to be utilized. With type 1 diabetes, we destroy the quote-unquote ingredients that would go on to make insulin in our bodies. So then I call it, like my kids know that I call it hormone replacement. So I have to inject subcutaneously, as you know, every day, all day long. I'm actually on an insulin pump, which delivers every few minutes, delivers a little microdose. So with type 1 diabetes, you are injecting the insulin that you need to sustain life. Often with type 2s can also inject insulin. So they just, it really, care team really look at the profile of the individual as to what they need, and can be a combination of oral medications, lifestyle intervention, injected insulin as a way to manage the diabetes. And often what they're looking at is glucose management. And insulin is, you need insulin to impact that, your glucose management. So often what happens
what I was wondering, though, is are you taking different treatments than you did 30 years ago? Like, have there been any scientific advances for diabetes?
There have been significant amounts of medical device advancements. Currently, they're using elements of artificial intelligence in the medical devices, like the insulin pumps, and then we have a continuous glucose sensing technology, which has been fantastic. It's equally as important as the insulin pump advancements. And that's for if you're taking you're injecting insulin, you're taking, whether in type 1 or type 2 or whatever type, if you're using. They also have inhaled insulins. I currently don't use inhaled insulins, but some people will use that as well. And then the type of insulins have also evolved. What is interesting about that is even over 31 years, the cognitive load that the disease requires isn't necessarily less, but I'm going to state a caveat in that, and I'll explain it a little bit further. The artificial intelligence that's starting to show up now in some of these closed-loop systems, it's a hybrid system, and what I mean by that is the continuous glucose monitors, which are looking at the glucose level in the cells right beneath the skin and correlating it to a blood glucose level. They're using that information, that data, and then they're using some sort of software platform to interpret that data to move and change the dosing of the insulin automatically without me telling it to, which is how the old insulin pumps. I would always program my pump. I would enter in ratios. I would manage the pump, where now there's an element of hybrid technology where it's taking on an element of the decision making, which now I would have to say that.
What you're saying is, let me see if I can understand this correctly. Not such a job, but the problem with the diabetes is that you can't predict what your blood level is going to be, so you don't know how to treat it. So it gets low, and then it gets high, and then you're kind of like not really sure, what it's going to be or what it's going to. And if they could predict it with 100%, you're saying that diabetes would be a non-issue, is what you're saying, right?
It wouldn't necessarily be that it's a non-issue, because you're going to deal – if you had immediately acting insulin and dialed in technology that didn't have errors, then you would definitely find yourself living in the target of optimal blood sugar levels more often. Other kind of variables a lot of people don't take into consideration is there's upwards of 100 different things that are contributing to glucose levels, and – it's just easy to look at movement and food, but stress levels, sleep, hydration, counter-regulatory hormones, the moon. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are contributing.
Are you,
so there's not going to be.
Absolutely. Are you familiar with the type of diabetes called insulinoma?
Insulinoma?
Yes.
I am not familiar with that type of diabetes. Well, help me understand.
I don't know if it's a form of diabetes, but this story that I'm going to tell you, you might be able to kind of explain a little bit about what it is that happened. It was a scary thing in our family, and I haven't really told the story often on the show, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you now because it involves my mom. She's fine right now, by the way, but But what happened was that it was Christmas Eve, and my mom is a pretty, you know, altogether mentally, you know, strong person. She's not the kind of person to do something weird socially or something that is a little bit odd, you know. And
okay.
What happened was that she woke up and she was out of it. And what happened was she almost walked upstairs in her underwear on Christmas Eve when everybody was there eating, you know, lunch, Christmas Eve dinner with all the family.
Which was odd behavior, according to kind of how you're
describing
it. That
is odd behavior. Yeah, it's odd behavior for somebody who is, you know, it's mentally out of character from her mom. So what happened was that they took, and I think she saw a little bit of double vision, I think. And this was years ago. And so they took her to hospital, and they looked at her, and they found out that she had insulinoma. And they also, I think she had like a tumor that was removed in her stomach. And, you know, but I think that what I'm trying to say is it possible that insulin, if unregulated, could make you, say, see double or act strange or act weird or do things that are out of character?
Well, with insulin, an event that can happen is hypoglycemic event, which is when your blood sugars drop. And if there's dysfunction of insulin in your pancreas or to produce too much insulin, you absolutely would have those symptoms, which include vision impairment. And that can actually also happen with a hyperglycemia event, which is where you have too little insulin. And so, yeah, absolutely. There can be vision impairment, tingling in the body, cognitive attention is depleted. You can sweat, your tongue can go numb. So there's a whole spectrum of symptoms that can present for an individual when they're dealing with dysregulated insulin and glucose levels.
It was very scary. I mean, you know, when you have, I mean, somebody that you care about that much and, you know, everybody's, and it's like, she was really loopy. She just, you know, is not all there. And, you know, it's like, and that's just not how somebody would behave on Christmas Eve, you know. So,
right. It often can present almost symptoms as though someone's intoxicated.
Right.
So that's very common. And if you guys hadn't seen that behavior before, I could see where that was startling. It's interesting when you talk to firefighters,
yeah.
They will often say when they arrive on scene to distress, some of their more welcoming issues to treat would be a low blood sugar, because within 15 minutes you have this highly disoriented person who is shaky and trembling and in an anxious distressed state.
Yeah.
And you treat them with glucose,
and
in 15 to 20 minutes they're back to normal.
The way they all seem to, you know, act when they come to fire is, oh God, you know, always in the movies, that's the way it always is.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I don't know exactly what insulinoma is, but I think that whatever it is, it's the same sort of animal as diabetes, I would think, because it was very scary. I mean, after that, she had to change her diet and, you know.
Well, I did look it up quite quickly because I hadn't heard of it, and it is a tumor that's dealing with the elements that do create insulin in your body, and it can almost have an overproduction of insulin is what it's saying here in my quick little search. So that makes sense that she would be having more of a hypoglycemic event for an overproduction of insulin. It doesn't necessarily – I mean, there are some correlations, but it doesn't look that it is a type of diabetes. But it's very quick, my quick research. So I'm not claiming any expertise in this.
No, I know. I mean, you know, well, the only reason I brought it up is because of the word. insulin, you know, would indicate that it's similar to, I mean, if you can figure out diabetes, if somebody can figure out how to treat diabetes, then I think they could probably figure out how to treat whatever it is that she was going through. They did get rid of the tumor, and but it was just like, and I think the sad part is that mom is always very together. I mean, everybody that meets her says that she's so nice and she's so, and then it's almost like you have her in a position where, you know, you don't look like yourself, you know.
Right.
And
right.
I mean, yeah, it was,
I was working with a teenager yesterday who deals with hypoglycemic events. She does not have diabetes. She's just an athlete, and she is dealing, you know, she was looking to develop with me, co-create a strategy for her to use. She's a ballet, very active in ballet and academic courses and enrichment. And she shared that vulnerability that you just described when you're having a hypoglycemic event, and how that was, she didn't like kind of what showed up. She cries, and she didn't like that she cries, you know, when she has these hypoglycemic events. That was very uncomfortable for her. So it is true that it will allow a vulnerability that for people who are usually really put together and present a certain way, that can be removed.
I was going to tell you something else. We had a kid in our high school. His name was Kip. He looked like the kind of kid that would just, you know, pound you into the pavement. And just not another kind of kid that you want to run past with. And he was diabetic. But see, here's the thing. Okay? Here's the thing. There were times when you would talk to him, and the guy had a volcanic temper. I mean, like, he could look at you from across the miles, like a mile away, almost like a couple of, like, halfway across the yard, and you'd be, like, in a car, and he would scream at you, "What are you looking at?" You know? But then, other times, he was as gentle as a mouse. I mean, just the most gentle and delicate, and he would see me, hello, brother, you know, you know, just delicate as a mouse, gentle as a mouse, like somebody that you wouldn't think would hurt a fly. And he was like, his father was the chief of police for the state. And the kid would just go from extremes. So it's almost like you never really knew what to think with him, because you thought, is he someone that, you know, is going to snap like Mike Tyson and go crazy, or is he someone? And I think also, when you have, it's one thing to be diabetic, but it's another thing to be diabetic and be physically fit, like look like somebody that could, you know, take on 10 people, because it's like, I think what I'm trying to say is this, in a nutshell, is that if you get very, very upset, then, well, people will think, well, you know, she's just getting very, very upset. If I'm getting very, very upset, then people will think, well, Johnny's just getting very, very upset. But if you look like Dwayne Johnson, and you're getting very, very upset, then people are like, oh, my God, you know. And yeah. So I'm curious. I mean, with the people that you dealt with that were diabetes, and I'm talking about the ones that look like football players, is it a little scarier with them? Because, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you're anybody who has a physically dominant appearance with a tendencies towards emotional dysregulation, that's going to be something that they would want to give attention to, whether you have diabetes or not diabetes. And there's all sorts of contributing factors to just emotional dysregulation. And though diabetes can be one of them, there's also a significant amount of other things. So for that individual, it would be to be looking at, you know, what is within their control, what can they practice when they're not dysemotionally regulated to then give them more confidence and trust to when they have those feelings surface. So that's just a really individual, you know, type of case that you would look at to work with somebody.
Well, yeah, but, I think the sad part is that, I mean, big people who look like football players, they have a right to be assertive too, you know, just like you and I do. But it's like the moment that they get assertive, everybody sort of goes, I don't think he was diabetic, but there's this guy that I went to our college named Chris. And the guy was in the Army, and, you know, the word around the campus was you did not mess around with Chris. Chris will kill you. Chris will, you know, will kill everybody that runs in. And it didn't matter who the other person was. You know, if you named another person, you know. But the one thing that everybody knew about Chris was that Chris would never hit a girl. He would never do it. I mean, a woman would be like yelling at him and screaming at him. He wouldn't do it. You know, he just won't do it. And the thing is that a lot of people who would see him get mad don't know that. So when he would get mad, you know, with his girlfriend, he would be screaming, you know, back and forth at his girlfriend, but everybody who saw it knew that, you know, he wouldn't do anything. It's just, you know, but what I'm curious about, though, is have you ever had a situation where your diabetes has affected your emotions and made you a little bit not all there?
Well, anytime you're dealing with glucose outside of an optimal range, you're going to have symptoms that present. And so, and especially with a low blood sugar event, you're going to have more of that vulnerability exposed. I personally don't sense it with elevated glucose, but I do when I have a low blood sugar glucose event, I know for myself personally that I just need to dose with my treatment of carbohydrates and find a quiet, safe place for myself for 15 to 30 minutes until I start to see the trend of my glucose start to go back into my optimal range that I'm targeting for. So I personally, due to the desires I've had in my life, and as we kind of touched on early on, I tend to adventure into some wild places where some risks are higher. So I've absolutely prioritized making sure I have safe environments for when those, it's like when that exists, I am one to announce my diabetes. People know I have diabetes. It's not a limitation for me. I think I shared with you, I just climbed Whitney last week and I went with 9 girlfriends and people didn't even really inquire about my diabetes per se because they knew I had it. Like, and they knew if I needed any support or help that I would be vocal about that. And that's just my personality. So I've been fortunate in that I don't tend to, there are emotions that present, but I have such a foundation of how I treat when those go to that place that I just have a trust in myself. But I absolutely work with clients who are navigating that differently. They've had, whether it's traumatic events with low blood glucose or just different emotions that present, and they have to address that and any trauma that sets in, and that is real for some people, for sure.
I also think that what happens is there is a sometimes what will happen is disabilities. It's not really – I think I don't know if – you and I were both on the boot camp last time.
In April. Correct.
But the the second.
Were you in April? Is that the one you were on?
I was on in April, but I was also on another one back in, I think, October. And okay. What happened? Actually, it was August. And when I came on, I think the hard part is how do you tell people about your disability? Because it's you know, if you, like, if you mention it, then you are, like, sometimes, like, for example, learning disabilities, you're actually doing two things when you're telling someone about your learning disability. One, you're telling people how to communicate with you better, and two, you're telling someone how to make you look like an idiot. Because if you tell someone you're dyslexic, well, you know, all they got to do to make you look like an idiot is just use a lot of big words and you know, or if you have a disability about numbers, you know, just talk about numbers. Or if you're blind, you know, do things, say things, you know, when you're far, too far away. Or if you're deaf, you know, understand what I'm saying. So I told everybody that I was Asperger's or on the autistic spectrum, and I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. But I tell people that, so like, oh, okay, well, he can't, you know, I mean, like, oh, the rocking, okay, he rocks back and forth, well, that's why. And obviously when you have a diabetic thing and you get emotional, oh, well, that would make sense. You know, I mean, does it feel differently? Do you sense anything like when the diabetes happens or?
When I have an event. Yeah, I do want to address, though, that's a really great point that you bring up around sort of if you're dealing with a health condition or really anything going on in your life and how you, the story that you surround it with. It's not entirely all that different than how Jen and Chris described it for the boot camp, which is really about the getting clarity about the message you want to present and surround yourself with. And I think that's one thing that's really important for people, anybody dealing with any really life event that's significant and it's taking up a lot of cognitive space or it's something that you have accommodations around or need. It's really getting a comfort and a clarity around the message that you're presenting with it. I personally don't, my story isn't sympathy grabbing either. I am very emotional based. I need support. I need someone to sit with me. I don't feel good. It's just very clear cut. Or, you know, I'll be on a run with my girlfriends and I'll be like, I have glucose. I'm going to, you know, hang back on the trails for 15 minutes. I'll either catch you guys later or regroup with you, or they'll wait back with me. So I'm very consistent in my messaging for myself, for what my goals are, what I'm optimizing for. So one thing that I would suggest to people is just get really clear. If you are looking to be heard and validated in your emotions, that's going to come across in your messaging around whatever challenge or circumstance, situation, or condition you're dealing with. If it's, you know, support you're looking for or guidance or assurance, whatever that is, you getting clarity around that, just like you would messaging for a business, is going to help you when emotions get a little dysregulated or circumstances come up where you might need that help. So I think getting clear in your messaging,
well, you know,
and how you
yeah.
want to present yourself.
Because I'm thinking this is one of the things I've noticed, and I know that I'm sort of getting off topic, but not much. I did some research, and I found out that, like, you know, there were – it is true. I have looked at Sarah Palin, and I thought, maybe she's dyslexic. And I saw the same thing about George W. Bush, and I saw the same things about Dan Quayle. I mean, Dan, you know, when you really think about it, being dyslexic would certainly explain the potato incident, you know. It would explain it. I mean, but actually I think it was like he got it from a car or something. But anyway, that's beside the point. The point is that would these people get the help they needed if they told everybody that they were dyslexic? But then on the other hand, they're telling people how to make them look stupid. I mean, you understand? And it's kind of like you can tell someone who has, like, for example, with me, if you saw, I can type really okay, but my handwriting looks like I'm 4. So if you go by my handwriting, or here's another example, get back with the diabetes, there are certain things I would not ask you to do because you have diabetes. Or I can ask you, I can put you in situations that's going to aggravate the diabetes, like, make the diabetes really act up and flare up, and then you're going to, this is not an ideal situation for you to be presented. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I see what you're saying, but it's not anybody else's position to tell me what I do or I do not need, and it's not my expectation when I share my story how someone will or will not take it. That is theirs. So what they want to do with that information is theirs. They do not have the ability to make me feel stupid. Now, they can be unkind, they can lack compassion and empathy, and that is theirs. That doesn't have anything to do with the story and the message that I'm trying to deliver. And I have no expectation when I go to meals or restaurants, or I don't have limitations around my diabetes and what I live. I have a purpose and a way that I want to live and the message that I surround that with. And that's what I put out in my life. What people do with it or don't do with it is up to the people. I don't operate in a way with expectations for that.
Now, let
so
me ask
an
you
example
this.
Is
the people in your sorry.
How does
go
people
on.
My life what?
Oh, I was wondering, yeah, how do the people in your life detect like when you need help with diabetes, like your family, et cetera?
So they don't detect it. I am very vocal about it. I am excellent at knowing the boundaries and limitations. I have the assistance of my devices that will either beep or alert me, and then I just state it out loud. An example, I was the primary caregiver to my kids when they were younger, and I breastfed each of them until they were over 2 years of age. And that put me in a situation where I was caretaking for newborns and a vulnerability. So I had to get really clear. I had to know to keep my sensitivities high, keep the support around me. I had to have glucose available in the different situations next to my rocking chair, on my person, in my glove compartment, on my bedside table. So if I got into a situation that was created a lot of stress and I didn't have what I needed, that gave me information to modify it or adapt. So I don't, you know, the people in my life don't tell me what I need. I'm exceptional at stating what I need. So
I understand. I just thought maybe they might, because they're around you so much, they might be good at picking up some things.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I just also spoke with a husband of a woman living with type 1 who I'm offering health coaching for, and he asked that exact question. So that's something that we're navigating right now, how he can be of support to her. And it's really individual in each relationship what the two people are looking for as far as support and needs. Some people have a seeing eye dog that can, for children that are not seeing eye dog, but a support dog that can sense, can smell low blood sugars before some of the medical devices can sense it. So each individual
wow.
family, you know, they kind of put into their adaptations and their support kind of what they need. I've been really fortunate, knock on wood, with how I manage my diabetes and the needs around my diabetes.
Now, I have a question. Have you ever treated somebody who has autism who has diabetes?
I have never. I have a lot of, I do have health coaching clients that are on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, but none that have had the co-diagnosis of diabetes and autism.
Because I think that would be really difficult because, you know, with what you have, the key to dealing with it is being verbal. But, like, I was just thinking about my nephew, Alex. First of all, he's really strong. He weighs like about 240 pounds, and it's like nobody can really tell when he's going to have a temper tantrum, you know. And I mean, you know how, like with them, things have to be a certain way, you know, and if it's not a certain way, they get upset, you know.
Yeah, overwhelm can set in inconsistently and quite easily.
I mean, wow. But the ones that you treated that were on the spectrum, what was that like?
Well, you know, I don't, it's not, my coaching method has an element of a fairly simple framework, and it has so much more to do with the individual and what they're desiring. And when I support and guide people, I'm coming from this rooted place of desire within them. And so it's just meeting them where they are, getting into experience with them, and then together we co-create a path to get towards what they desire. And as things unfold and old patterns surface, we look at them with curiosity and compassion. So the person presents this, their own deck of cards in their work with me. So I wouldn't say that there's anything unique about working with someone on the spectrum versus someone off on the spectrum, in that it's still the same process. It might have different branches to it, but it's really looking at that sensory funnel of looking at the base of the sensations and the emotions, letting go of executive functioning, and really looking at the basis of overwhelm, which is often getting into that defense mode. And people on the spectrum, it's where they go to, it's where they've been patterned to go to, because things in their environment just trigger those sensations into overwhelm so often.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because just like my nephew falls into the category of, you know, somebody that you don't want to mess with, because he's very, very strong, you know. And
right. And so, you know, one thing we could have started with health coaching is, you know, kind of what is it? It's a new and emerging field. And health coaching, people come to me looking for support in typically one of the domains of health. They might not have it that specified, but that's sort of what we unfold and work on together. And if someone has a desire to look at something for themselves, that's where I go with my clients. I look at that desire. There is power and energy in that desire. And where I really take people, and it's kind of something that we spoke to on our call before, is I use the adventure mindset, which really puts one in the position of possibilities versus focusing on the problems. And when you start looking at what's possible, you kind of start forgetting about what the problems are.
Right.
So it just helps move people and gain momentum towards what they want in their life.
Well, a good example about that, or towards my nephew, because my guess is that I think you don't just deal with people who have diabetes, you probably deal with people who have other things too. My dad was telling me today that one of the chores, they're teaching him to do like chores, things that he can do that are, you know, and I guess in a way it would be sort of a vocational thing. And when you really think about it, even though he is like nonverbal and autistic, there is something about what my father was telling him, that if he was to just tone, a lot of people who would be like, oh my God, I want this guy working for me. Because what happens is he, one of his chores at the place was where he goes to, is he feeds the horses and he washes the windows. They teach him how to wash the windows. But what happened was that he came home, I think it was like 9 o'clock at night, and he wanted to wash the windows really badly. Otherwise, when you really think about it, that's actually kind of productive of him. You know, I mean, he says that, I mean, he was upset unless he wanted to work. So the only thing is that, you know, he washes the windows and he does a good job, except that after he gets done, he always takes his hand and he touches it on the window. And Chrissy, my sister, has to come in and wipe it off. But like what you said about concentrating on what's possible rather than impossible, I think that's a very proud thing that he does that washing the windows, because there are people that are going to see that and they're going to think, oh my God, I want to hire this kid, you know, because, you know, and his interactions, like things that he does, I don't want to get up on a tangent on myself, but I think that obviously you've dealt with people like this. But, like, at Christmas time, like, one of the things they did with him is they would take him out, and then he would let him pick out things, and then he would give it to my sister so that he was picking out the present, you know?
Absolutely.
And see, because I'm on the spectrum myself, and it took me a little while to kind of deal with it, so, but, you know, and then you realize, as you get on there with the deal with the kids, you realize that they deal with things, but then the way they see things actually gives you a sense of clarity. Like, I don't know how much you've dealt with. I mean, have you dealt with a lot of people on the spectrum?
I am very familiar with the symptoms that present on the spectrum. So, yeah.
Because, like, one of the things that my older nephew, Van, does is he would lose it when he was younger and he lost a tooth. His mom, my sister, told him to, put it under the pillow, but he freaked out about the idea of a tooth fairy coming into his room because he didn't want a complete stranger coming into his room when he's asleep. So
that's completely appropriate for a child who's been probably programmed.
And then he said that he wanted to. So what they did was he would leave the tooth in the mailbox, and
adaptation.
He would get a dollar. What?
You adapt. You have things that present,
right,
and you see whether they are or aren't working, and you create adaptations to them.
I know. He was just well. What's so funny is that they are, you know, they're all very sweet kids, you know, but the way they see things is just kind of, I don't know. My guess is, I mean, I forgot to ask you, do you have kids? Oh, that's right.
I have a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old, yes.
Okay, I'm just curious. I mean, like, I guess I didn't really ask you the specifics about what their ages were or anything about your age. What have they taught you? I mean, obviously, because what I'm trying to say is, you mean they don't detect that anything is up with you when you have an attack, or do you think they don't know, or do you think they know?
Well, I want to reiterate that for me, in the way that I've lived my life, it's rather independent. Being diagnosed when I was 17, and then a year later I went off to college, and then my desire to spend extensive amount of time in wild and adventurous places, I just have really had to set my tolerances to be that I can take care of and handle. So I'm very a sensitivity on all my devices. So it's not often what occurs is if I feel a hypoglycemic event present, I inform those around me. So I am letting people know around me before they would detect any shift in behavior or something like that. My kids have taught me a tremendous amount about really unconditional love and support in meeting people where they are. I have individuals where they are. I've learned a tremendous amount from being a parent and parenting my two children.
I guess the reason I asked about people who are Asperger's or autism, or in other words, selective mutism, because you say, you know, it's one thing to be able to speak up when you have an attack. Like, what do you do if the kid can't, somebody can't speak up? You know, they're not going to speak up.
So
I mean,
that's a really good question. And when I say speak up, it's communicate. So if I was working with a client who had things in their environment or conditions or circumstance or situations where certain things had more of a challenge, we really dig into the desire. What are they looking for support and guidance around? I talk about using the adventure mindset of, like, what excites you? What are you excited about? What the anticipation of, and what inspires you? What brings you, you know, makes you have that sense of fulfillment? That's where I go, and that's where I dive. And I use that as a platform to assist in the other areas where there's constant challenge. So it's a real, it's a mindset shift for people. And so it comes down to communication. So it really depends. I mean, if you want to give me a specific example, I'd be happy to, you know, we could sort of dialogue around how I would approach that.
It's just like, I guess the reason is, I mean, is because I was talking to you, an example of, I mean, what do you mean by an example?
So if there was someone I was, my coaching is done verbally, so that would be
right.
completely new for me to explore how to work
okay.
with a client in a
right.
nonverbal realm, which would not intimidate me. I would welcome that opportunity.
See, like, for example,
and then I would
just
go there.
I think selective mutism, for example, and I'm not really that familiar with it, but there's some people the words just don't come out. I mean, my nephew, if he were diabetic, he would probably have a tantrum before he would say anything.
It's just looking at the experts in their support realm. I'm not an expert in looking at, I'm not a therapist or an aide or something like that. I'm looking to help people take their desires and health and bring them towards those desires, co-create a path to get there along with them. So if someone has a desire to work with me as a health coach, then there's ground that we can make together. And typically what I would do then is invite the rest of their healthcare support team to work along with us. And those systems are probably or typically already set in place, the other aspects of their healthcare team, to make it to make my health coaching effective.
Now I'm curious, because it says that you do things like, it says here in your bio, you swim in frigid water and you spend days running across mountains. And, I guess what I'm curious about is, let's say that you are out swimming in the ocean and then all of a sudden you feel an attack. Well, I mean, you can't just, I mean, what do you do in that situation? Because, I mean, if you're out in the water or if you're out, let's say that you're out on a raft somewhere or, where you can't get, I mean, how do you handle that? Because obviously you can't, what if you can't get to the thing that's going to give you insulin?
That is such an excellent question. And that particular barrier is why a lot of people don't. They can't even look to the realm of what's possible. And I feel very fortunate in that I use it as information. I mean, there's preparation that occurs. There's patterns that I need to be familiar with. I wouldn't probably engage in something that's significantly outside of the realm of what I'm prepared for or have experience with without some sort of awareness or mitigation, meaning it's super easy for someone to put like a glucose gel inside of a wetsuit when they're surfing. I typically carry glucose, or like for me, I do a sunrise swim every Fridays, and I'm going in a fasted state, which means I don't have extra insulin that I've injected, so my base insulin levels are fairly low. I will often, if it's going to be a longer swim, I will start depleting my insulin levels hours before the swim, and then the particular system I wear is waterproof, both of them, the continuous glucose monitor and the insulin pump, so I can keep those on my body, and then I just, the device that I wear that shows me my levels, it's a little phone, I can look at that when I get in and out. And it's just this patterning. It's developing a trust from me doing these things consistently again and again and again. Matter of fact, my hike up to Whitney last week.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No. Go on with what you're saying.
So I shared with you, and I mentioned earlier in this call, I hiked up to the summit of Mount Whitney last week, which is the highest peak in the lower 48. And it's not a technical hike, but because it was late spring, there were some elements of ice and snow covering. And we actually had 30 to 40 mile per hour winds fairly consistently throughout the day, which with the already cold temperatures presented frostbite element temperatures, which were very cold. And it was 12 hours of strenuous activity. And my glucose remained, interestingly enough, I finished at the exact same glucose level I started with very minimal variability over the 12 hours. That was available to me. That occurred because I've spent thousands of hours in wild places knowing my needs and what I need to do and how I need to adapt and how I need to fuel and how I need to hydrate and layer and keep warm and do different things. I didn't just show up and that happened. It happened because I engaged in the experience again and again and again, consistently, always learning, always making little adaptions as I need, and really knowing my body, knowing my medical devices, knowing the risks of what could fail, have backups around. So though the day I didn't have to think that much about my diabetes, it took thousands of hours to arrive there.
I mean, let me ask you this question. I know this is hard to predict, but let's look ahead another 30 years. What do you think? Do you think that the liver today will be able to cure diabetes?
It's a really good question. I think before in 30 years with a cure, I will go back to an interesting story, actually. I was diagnosed in 1990, and in 2000, I had this opportunity to be on this expedition team called International Diabetes Expedition Aconcagua. It's called IDEA 2000, and it was 19 athletes from around the world all came together for research on glucose levels and diabetes and altitude, and we climbed up Aconcagua. I was just on the base camp support team, so there was a summit team. And we sat at our base camp support one evening, and we had a steak dinner actually brought up by our guides that brought our helped get our gear up to base camp. And each one of us, no matter if we had had diabetes 5 years or 20 years, had been told in 5 years there would be a cure. And it was kind of this running joke. And I can still remember sitting around that table and just being like, wait, in some ways it was bittersweet, right? Because there's been hope spread around the table for all 19 of us, whether we're from Spain, the Czech Republic, Italy, the U.S., Canada, and all told there'd be a cure in 5 years, and yet I'd had it 10, and we're nowhere close to a cure, and now I've had it 31. And the energy is really put towards managing the disease. And not that there's not research occurring towards the cure. Personally, the amount of energy that's going towards developing the vaccine for COVID, if those resources and energy went towards the global pandemic of diabetes, would we have a cure? It's just not what's being done. It's not the priority.
Yeah, I will say this now, and I am vaccinated myself, but, like, the thing that's interesting about that I was just thinking, I mean, like, what they did, they kind of broke the rules with COVID because of the idea that it's not, well, normally you would get FDA approved, which would take years, but then they had, like, an emergency. So the question is that, well, if they treated diabetes like an emergency, what would happen? And is what I've often wondered about. Now, I do think that, obviously, the reason I think that there may not have be a cure is because science tends to get nervous when it comes to trying things. And it's like, for example, the stem cell research baby. You know, it's possible because stem cell research is controversial, but if they were to come up with something with stem cell research, I would think it would, you know, probably help people with diabetes. Don't you think?
Well, the research, there is stem cell research that is occurring with rejuvenating the islet cells. So that is already occurring. I think, you know, in 30 years, who knows? I think what's going to occur before that is we're going to have medical devices that are able to really take the cognitive load of the disease. Right now, that's starting to occur. But up to this point, if you wanted to utilize the medical devices, there was a barrier of entry in that you really needed to up your game in the management. So you really had to be participating in the troubleshooting and the risks if the medical devices failed. And some of that is being curtailed currently with the advancements, and now some of it's starting to take the cognitive load off with artificial intelligence. So I think we're going to see that trend. And so before a cure, what's going to happen is we're really going to figure out how to more optimally normalize glucose levels and have these medical devices intervene before people have these hypoglycemic events. That's already
HIV is something else, because, I mean, I remember when this is really true. I've heard of people say this. They say this. They will look. I don't know if you've heard this or not, but they'll be like, "How come Magic Johnson isn't dead yet from HIV?" And they're not wishing him well or anything. They just they find it hard to believe that he's still alive. And it's sort of like HIV sort of is still around, but there it's sort of like for years there was a lot of misconceptions about it, just like there might be misconceptions about diabetes. Like if somebody were to think about you as diabetic, you know, they might think, oh, well, I bet Tara sits at home all day long and has, and then, you know, her day is composed of reading and injecting herself, you know, which apparently based on your bio, that's not the case.
Correct. Well, that's another interesting point you bring up around there is a significant, I think one of the, well, absolutely the larger problem with diabetes is the shame and blame that is promoted within the healthcare system, with media, with culture, in the society. It's this idea that people can prevent, like people want to blame people for getting their disease. And that just lacks compassion and the outcome that we're desiring. It just perpetuates habits of dysfunction and keeping people in the cycle of illness. So that's a big soapbox of mine, actually. And I can defend myself out of it pretty quick because of the lifestyle choices that I have personally. But as people living with diabetes, it's just really unfortunate. It makes people not want to speak up and say when they need help or even share with people that they have a condition that might need support. There's just too much shame around
it. Like what I did.
And now
kids
are getting
college,
diagnosed.
Well,
pardon me?
Like when I was in college, I was, I would always, you know, when I went to the cafeteria, I would say, can someone help me make some coffee? Because my hands would shake. And then, you know. But, well, we're about out of time. But I wanted to thank everybody and for listening to you. And I'd like to say that you have a website. Can you give your website out?
Absolutely. It's betweendiabetes.com. So.
Okay. And I must say that, I mean, it's been a lot of fun having you on. This show,
well, thank
this
you.
Video is going to be uploaded to YouTube and also uploaded to our Roku channel as well. You have Roku, right?
I don't. I used to. I do not anymore, but absolutely can be YouTube.
Right. Well, so. Thank you for coming on, and Barbara, if you're listening, I love you, and I hope to see you back on here soon. Good night, everyone.
Well, good night, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you.